week we look at a number of examples in the Old Testament. By the way, not all of your sermon notes are we going to get through, and I'm not really worried about that. I want to begin with reading a number of statements. God is not worried who will win this election or any election for that matter. God is not worried. God's kingdom does not rise or fall on the winds of political change. God does not wait for the latest polls to come out, because God already knows what is in the heart of man. The prayer of the church and of the disciples of Jesus should always remain the same, the prayer that is part of the Lord's Prayer, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." This week kids, if you want to step out with Miss Allison for junior church, you can do that quietly. This week, as we look at the Old Testament, we look at God is sovereign no matter who is in charge, and we look especially through the eyes and the experience of Joseph, of Moses, of Daniel, of Mordecai and Esther, and I'll go into a little more explanation on that, and even through the eyes of Cyrus, who himself was not a king of Israel, but really was a pagan king. The next week, we'll look through the New Testament and say, what is the attitude and role of us towards government, especially looking at Jesus and John the Baptist, and then going into the rest of the New Testament. You need a Bible. Turn to Genesis chapter 39. You need a Bible because I'd like you to see these words for yourself. When we think of the story of Joseph, we don't think of somebody who had a trajectory of getting into power because he built a good base and had a super PAC. Listen to me. Joseph was not a person that should have been picked to make anything. Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers. His family wouldn't even back him. His brothers sold him into slavery, hoping to get rid of him, sent him off with the Ishmaelites. They took him to Egypt. He goes into slavery. He's there serving Potiphar. He's lied about. He is accused falsely. He's thrown into prison on false charges, and he is put into the dungeon. Okay. Wow, you know, that's a real good way to get to the top seat, right? No, he's gone to the lowest of lows, and then somebody who he helped, he is forgotten by them. There is no political favors here. He is forgotten by this guy for numbers of years. Not exactly a success. But that is not true. What you are going to see in each of these occasions is that these people, by God's hand, serve in foreign and pagan governments, and God's will is done even though the government is not friendly towards God. God does not need friendly governments to get his will done. Turn to Genesis chapter 39. What I want you to see is in each occasion, God's hand is on Joseph. In chapter 39, we read about Joseph in Potiphar's house. Look at verse 2. The Lord was with Joseph, and he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him, you know, Potiphar didn't say, oh, you have the God of Jacob on you. Okay? We'll get to that in a minute. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted into his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So he left, and Joseph cared everything he had. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food that he ate. Did Potiphar say, you know what, Joseph, you know, I know that you are from the God of Jacob. I know that you have an A-plus rating with Family Research Council, and so I'm going to put you in charge of my whole household. No, you know what Potiphar saw? He saw that the character of this person demonstrated that there was something in him. There was something on him. We know that it's the hand of God. Joseph knew that it was the hand of God. What Potiphar saw is that everything, what? Blossomed under this man's control. And so it says that Potiphar gave everything into his hands except the food that he ate. The only thing he didn't let Joseph do was feed him. Everything else Joseph took care of. And when Joseph was taking care of it, guess what happened? Business was good. The business was growing. Potiphar could sit back. All he had to worry about was getting the spoon to his mouth. Pretty good, right? Everybody wants that kind of employee. His wife tries to trap Joseph and then lies about him. And he ends up in the dungeon. But God's hand is still on him. See, just because things are going bad in your life doesn't mean that God's hand isn't on you. Just means his hand is taking you by a different route. Look at chapter 39, verse 21. This is when Joseph is in the prison. But while Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. Now, Joseph could have said, well, I'm abandoned by God. I mean, look, how bad can this be? I'm sold into slavery by my brothers. I'm starting to make good in Potiphar's household, and then she lies about me, and here I am in the very dungeon. No, Joseph doesn't resort to self-pity, which many of us might. The Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden, so that the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention. What did it say about Potiphar? There was nothing that he worried about. What's it say here about the prison warden? The warden paid no attention to the things that were under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success whatever he did. Why did the warden put him in charge? Because when Joseph was in charge, everybody got along. There were no riots. There was no hunger strikes. There were no people making knives out of bed springs. There was none of that. Okay? When Joseph was in charge, it ran smoothly. And why? Because what? God's hand was on Joseph. Did the warden come and say, you know, are you a believer? No. What the warden knew was when he looked at Joseph, he looked at somebody who kept things running smoothly. You see, these are pagan people, but they see the hand of God on the believer. Well, you know much of Joseph's story. He interprets the baker and the butler, and the baker gets hung, and the butler gets put back in place, but the butler forgets about him, and then Pharaoh has a dream, and suddenly the guy has his memory back. Turn to Genesis chapter 41. So they get Joseph, and they say, Joseph, Pharaoh needs his dream interpreted. Look at chapter 41, verse 39. Joseph has interpreted the dream. He tells him that the 7 years of good are coming, and then the 7 years of famine. He tells Pharaoh, you better get a plan together because this is what's going to happen. I want you to look chapter 41, verse 39. Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has made this known to you, all this plan of the 7 years and the 7 years of abundance and famine, and there is no one so discerning and wise as you are, you will be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only respect to the throne will I be greater than you. I want you to notice the same thing that Potiphar did, the same thing that the warden did, is the same thing that what? Pharaoh does. Why? Because he went to a rally and he heard him say some really good phrases? No, because he sees in him something that he cannot explain. And it's the hand of God. Look at verse 55 and 57. This is very interesting. Pharaoh really shows the confidence that he had in Joseph. Okay, so the famine has now come, and in verse 55, when all Egypt began to feel the famine, the people cried to Pharaoh for food. Well, who are you going to cry to? Well, of course you're going to go to cry to Pharaoh. Then Pharaoh told all the Egyptians, what? Go to Joseph. Go to Joseph and do what he tells you. And when the famine had spread over the whole country, Joseph opened the storehouse and sold grain to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe throughout Egypt, and all the countries came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, because the famine was severe in all the world. You remember Joseph's dream? Well, here the whole world is coming to him. Did Joseph see this as a time for a political play? No, not at all. If you read Joseph's testimony, let's go back to some of these same scenarios. Chapter 41, verse 16. Joseph is talking to his brothers, and this is the right after he's revealed who he really is. And listen to what he says. There we go. I'm in the wrong chapter. Chapter 41, verse 16. Actually, this is his discussion with Pharaoh. I cannot do it, Joseph replied to Pharaoh, but God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires. Okay? What did Joseph say to Pharaoh? Did Joseph say, listen, Pharaoh, I'd like to broker a little bit of a deal here. You know, I know the interpretation, but right now, you know, I've been in this dungeon, you know, and I just want to make sure before I give you the answer that I have your signature here that after, no. You know what Joseph says? Listen, Pharaoh, I can't do this. But God has sent me to tell you what needs to happen. Look at verse 28 of that same chapter. It is just as I said, Pharaoh, God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. There was something that was true of many of the kings in these days, Pharaoh included, and then later we're going to look at Nebuchadnezzar. They believed that they were God. They believed that they could order things as they should go. They could tell they didn't like somebody that they should die. They could tell somebody that they could live. They tried to control the sun. They tried to control the Nile. They tried to control all these things. And you know what? Pharaoh has to realize that Joseph has told him that for 7 years they're going to have bumper crops, and then for 7 years they're going to have nothing. Pharaoh, you cannot control this country. For 7 years you're going to have great abundance, and you better find somebody who knows what to do with that abundance. And then for 7 years, Pharaoh, you're going to be powerless to do anything because there's going to be no food. The Nile, the God of the Nile is not going to be able to do anything. There is going to be no God of rain that's going to be able to do anything. Ra, the God of the sun, is not going to be able to do anything because this is what the Lord God has said. You see, what I like about Joseph and Daniel and what I like about Moses is they never put it in terms other than giving credit to Almighty God. They never went to them and said, well, you know, science and El Nino shows us that, you know, we should do this and we should do that and we should do that. No, they said, you know what, Pharaoh, you know what? For 7 years, you're going to have some good crops. And then for 7 years, there's nothing you can do because it's going to be famine. And God has shown this to you, Pharaoh. I want to make sure that when we talk to people, shortchange God on representing him. We need to tell them directly what he says and how he says it. We can tell them with grace, but we also must tell them the truth. And his church needs to be those who uphold his name, just like these guys, in front of kings who thought that they were God. And yet they said, God has a message for you, and the message is this: you're not in charge. Turn to Genesis 45. How did Joseph view what was happening to him? How did he deal with it? This is as he, now I'm to the right place. This is as he is talking to his brothers. He says to them, verse 4, come close to me. When they had done so, he said, I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. Well, wait a minute. Who was it that sent you to Egypt? He just said you were the ones who sent me to Egypt into slavery, but now he says what? It was God who sent me. You see, you guys thought you were doing something on your own, but actually your jealousy and your anger played right into the plan of God. And the Bible says that in the book of Psalms, even the wrath of man brings praise to God. Because a lot of the things that man is trying to do, God has a way of turning them right around. Let's go on. And now, do not be distressed, do not be angry for selling me, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now there has been famine in the land, and for the next 5 there will be no plowing or reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And then he says this, he made me father to Pharaoh and lord of his entire household and ruler of all Egypt. Wow. Do you know what he just said about Pharaoh? What does it mean if you're a father of somebody? It means that they follow your directions. Well, we hope. It means that they listen to you. And Joseph says here, listen, I am like a father to Pharaoh. He's like my son. He follows my directions. But Joseph does not see this in the context of him now being on the top of the political heap. He sees this as God's way of bringing deliverance to his own family who had sold him into slavery. You see, God doesn't need friendly family members or friendly governments to what? To get his will done. It always helps. Does help, but he doesn't need it, and neither do we. In fact, if you turn over a couple more pages to Genesis chapter 50, Joseph makes this clear to his brothers right after his father has died. He says in chapter 50, verse 19, do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, speaking to his brothers, but God intended this for good, to accomplish what is being done now, the saving of many lives. So then don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children. Listen, you guys meant it to do me wrong, and God turned it around to do good. And you know what? I ended up doing good to you who meant to do wrong to me. Let's look at Moses. Turn over to Exodus chapter 3. God is always sovereign, no matter who is in charge. Because God will accomplish his will, whether the person in charge wants it to be accomplished or not, because God is above all kings and he is sovereign. When Moses is going to bring out the children of Israel, God tells him the truth. He tells him, Moses, you're going to have a hard time right from the beginning. Pharaoh is not going to want to listen to you. Usually when you go and you try to sell somebody on a job, you don't tell them the bad sides, right? You tell them all the good sides, all the benefits, all the perks, all the authority, the office, You let them find out the bad stuff on their own because why? You want them to take the job. That's not what God does. God tells Moses right from the beginning. Look at Exodus chapter 3. He's having this discussion with Moses. Moses has not agreed. In fact, Moses is about to give God about a list of four or five excuses why he is not the person. Okay? In Exodus chapter 3, verse 18, he says this to Moses. The elders of Israel will listen to you. Okay, that's a good start. Then you and the elders are to go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. Let us take a three-day journey into the desert to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God. But I know, what? The king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand compels him to do so. So I will stretch out my hand and strike the Egyptians with all the wonders that I will perform among them, and after that he will let you go. He says, listen, the king of Egypt, he's not going to listen to you unless there is a hand that comes along and gets him, shoves him in the direction of doing what I have already commanded is to be done. And by the way, when I am done, he'll let you go. Well, you know the story. Moses goes, talks to him. Turn over to Exodus chapter 6. I want to show you a progression. And this is why I want you to look at it in the Bible. You know, sometimes we lose the details. But you got to see this progression. In Exodus chapter 6, verses 6 and 7, this is what God says about how he's accomplishing this. That same day, Pharaoh gave this order. Chapter 6. Therefore, say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and the mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. God says, Israel, when you see what I'm going to do to accomplish your freedom, you will know I am God. Okay? His own people will see this and they will know this is God. This is Jehovah. This is the covenant-keeping God, and he has done these mighty acts to bring us out because we are his people and he is our God. Skip over to chapter 7. Remember, God says, they will know, my people will know I am God. Chapter 7, verse 1. Then the Lord said to Moses, see, I have made you like God to Pharaoh and your brother Aaron like your prophet. You are to say everything I have commanded you, and your brother Aaron is to tell Pharaoh to let the Israelites go out of his country. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I multiply miraculous signs and wonders in Egypt, he will not listen to you. Boy, that's really what you want to hear. They are going to harden their hearts, and they are absolutely going to turn you away. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt, and with mighty acts of judgment, I will bring out my divisions, my people, the Israelites, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the Israelites out. So who now will know? The people around them. Turn to Exodus 14. This is where Pharaoh thinks he has them between the hammer and the anvil. They're right in front of the Red Sea, and his army is coming right behind them. He thinks, this is it, man. I'm going to deal with these people. I'm going to drag them back. Some of them are going to die, but I'm going to drag them back, and they're going to be once again under my fist. And in chapter 14, the Lord says this about his triumph over them. Let's start at verse 13. Do not be afraid, stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians will see today, and the Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. And the Lord says to them, in verse 17, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them, and I will gain glory through Pharaoh and all his army and his chariots and his horsemen. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I gain glory through Pharaoh, his chariots, and his army. And you know what happens? When we go to the book of Joshua, and they're talking to Rahab, literally it says that all the nations knew that God was Lord. Rahab says to them, when we heard what God did at the Red Sea, all of us were shaking in our knees. Do you understand the progression here? God says, look, I want my people to know who I am. And then I want the people around them to know who I am. And because of what I do with my people and the people around, the whole world will know who I am. God doesn't need friendly governments to make his name great. What he needs is his own people to know who he is. Turn over to, we're going to look at Daniel. By the way, you're going to do the rest on your own. But we're going to look at Daniel. I want you to realize that the way Daniel got to Babylon was not that they did a search and they drafted the most likely candidates. That was not how Daniel got to Babylon. You know how Daniel got to Babylon? If you look at 2 Kings 24, Nebuchadnezzar came into Israel and he deported. He took away like the top citizens. Daniel was a prince in Israel and excuse me in Judah, and he was taken away and he was put into Nebuchadnezzar's training to undergo becoming Babylonian in your thinking, which Daniel refused to do, so that then Nebuchadnezzar could use them as his instruments to govern the people, and they would be friendly towards him because their own people were now in cahoots. That was basically the idea. Okay, now I want you to turn to an interesting passage. Maybe you've never seen this before. Turn to Jeremiah 24. Jeremiah 24, Jeremiah gives us a little peek behind the curtain. Jeremiah 24, verse 1. After Jehoiachin, son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and the officials and the craftsmen and the artisans of Judah were carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, the Lord showed me two baskets of figs placed in front of the temple of the Lord. I have a fig tree. Right now, the figs are just starting to turn. I love them. I can't eat too many of them because I can't eat too many seeds. But those first figs right off of there, listen to what it says. One basket had very good figs, like those that are ripened early. That's what I'm picking off of my fig tree right now, okay? The other basket had very poor figs so that they could not be eaten. You know what happens to our fig tree if you leave the figs on too long? The ants get inside of them, and they start eating it. And you'll bite into a fig, and instead of getting figs, you'll get ants, okay? Yuck. Listen to what he says then. Then the Lord asked me, what do you see, Jeremiah? He said, figs. The good ones are very good, but the poor ones are so bad they cannot even be eaten. And this is what the Lord said. Like those good figs, I regard the good exiles from Judah whom I sent away from this place to the land of the Babylonians. Do you know what he's saying? He's saying, I sent the good figs off to Babylon. And what's left now? The bad figs. Daniel was one of those good figs. He had been sent off to Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar thought that he was going to use these guys, put them into his system, Babylonianize them, and then use them to govern their own people. But that's not what happened to Daniel. What's interesting is that God says of, and you can look this up later, God says in Isaiah 3 that Israel for so long had rebelled against him that when God took Israel into captivity, that he allowed children to reign over the rest. And he wasn't talking about 10-year-olds. He was talking about the maturity level of the rulers that they were now left with. But it wasn't Daniel. The reason I show you that is because When we begin the book of Daniel, turn to Daniel chapter 2. You and I recognize who Daniel was, but Nebuchadnezzar had no idea. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. He wants the dream interpreted, and nobody can interpret it. I love Daniel and his friends. They always have somebody threatening that they're going to kill him, you know. And the first threat comes right here at the beginning, where none of the wise men can interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dream, because Nebuchadnezzar has done a very mysterious thing. He wants them to tell him the dream and then interpret it. You see, if he had just told him the dream, anybody could have come up with some interpretation. But he says, you got to tell me the dream. And right off the bat, Daniel and his friends are now being threatened because all the wise men are going to be killed. By the way, in chapter 3, they're going to be thrown into the fiery furnace. Chapter 4, he's going to be thrown into the den of lions. You know, in chapter 5, he goes through a coup. You know, it's on and on. God doesn't need friendly governments or stable governments to get his will done, does he? Was Daniel known because he had a great resume? No. If you turn to Daniel chapter 2, here's the first time that Daniel is being presented to the king. Chapter 2, verse 24. Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to execute the wise men of Babylon, and said to him, do not execute the wise men of Babylon. Take me to the king. I will interpret his dream for him. So Arioch took Daniel to the king at once and said, I have found Daniel. He's been endorsed by James Dobson. He's been endorsed by, you know, this person and that person. And now, O king, you know, I have brought... No, what does he say? Huh? What's he say? Arioch took Daniel to the king at once and said, I have found a man among the exiles from Judah. Nebuchadnezzar, remember those people, you know, that you had conquered over there? Well, one of them thinks that he's got something for you. That's how Daniel is known. A man from among the exiles from Judah who can tell the king what his dream means. So the king asked Daniel, who was also called Belteshazzar, are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream? And Daniel replied, no. Daniel, don't tell this man no. But Daniel is not going to back down from taking credit for something that what? That God does. No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in days to come. Your dreams and the visions that pass through your head as you lay on your bed are this. Daniel says, listen, king, I can't do this either, but God can. What I'd like you to think about is at the end of each of these encounters that these men have with pagan kings who are threatening to kill them, at the end, each pagan king makes a statement that the only God they really should worship is Daniel's God. The only God they really should worship is the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The only God that they really should worship is the God of the guy who just got out of the lion's den with all his limbs intact. The God who sends Nebuchadnezzar into the field insane, and at the end, Nebuchadnezzar says, I raised my eyes to heaven and I worshiped God. Daniel survived the lion's den. His friends survived the fiery furnace. Daniel survived the threat of having his life taken. And Daniel survived the change of kings when Belteshazzar ignored God and paid the price. I want to read one section, and that's that one, Daniel chapter 5. Belteshazzar thought that he knew better than God. And he got the temple, articles out, and he drank wine in the cups that had been used by the priest and in the worship of God. You see, there's a lot of times when people in this world think that they can thumb their nose at God and that God is not paying attention, or since they don't believe in God, what does it matter anyway? Belteshazzar was one of those kinds. And I want you to hear what happens to him. Verse 22, but you, his son, talking to Belteshazzar because he was the son, really probably the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all these things about your grandfather. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. Belteshazzar, you don't know who you're up against. You have the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives, and your concubines have drank wine from them. You praise the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, of iron and wood and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand, but you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. You hold his cups with contempt. But what you don't realize is he holds your very life in his hands. And by the way, you've been weighed, you've been found wanting, and tonight that life is required. You see, there's a world out there who thinks that they can capriciously ignore our God. And for a time, it will seem that he indeed can be ignored. But there is coming a day when the very one that they hold in contempt is the very one in which their hands even now rest. And God will not be held in contempt. If we were going to go on, we would look at Mordecai and Esther. I want you, as you read the book of Esther, to see how God uses both of them. Mordecai hears the plot. Mordecai is the one who gives Esther the information. Esther is the one who becomes the queen. Mordecai is the one who tells her, you better go and you better plead because you have come for such a time as this. And then Mordecai is put into Haman's place and he writes the edicts that save the people. But then he is put in second position. That's what I want you to see. These are all pagan governments that exalt the person of God to the very second position and acknowledge that there is a God even over them. And so it is with Mordecai, and so it is with Nehemiah, and so it is even with Cyrus, who was predicted in Isaiah 45 to be the one to declare that God's temple would be rebuilt. And in his command, decades later, hundreds of years later, he acknowledges that God is the one who has sent him and decreed that this is to be done. See, I want to say this over and over again. It doesn't matter who's in charge. It's always nice, it's always helpful, and that's what we'll look at in Peter. We are to pray that we are able to lead quiet and useful lives for God, but God's will be done whether those in charge acknowledge him or not. And by the way, in our own lives, God's will be done whether we acknowledge him or not. Blessed are those who do acknowledge him. Because like Joseph, like Moses, like Daniel, we're able to witness the hand of God in the doings of our own lives as well. We're going to pray, then we're going to spend some time praising, and then we're going to be done. Lord, I pray that you would give us wisdom.